Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time. In each episode of this podcast, we invite a special guest to take us on a tailored tour of the past. Travels Through Time is brought to you in partnership with History Today, Britain's best-loved serious history magazine. You can read articles relating to this podcast and more about our guests at historytoday.com/travels. There is also a special subscription offer for Travels Through Time listeners. 3 issues for just £1 each. Hello, you're listening to Travels Through Time, the podcast where we explore 1 year in history with an expert guest in 3 pivotal scenes. My name is Peter Moore, and after a few episodes rooted in the 20th century, we're now making a bigger leap back into the past. Today we're going to be talking about the Crusades, about the holy city of Jerusalem, and about the legendary Battle of Hattin. The year is 1187. And most of all, we're going to be talking about one of the most enduring heroes of the medieval era. He's a man that's revered both in the Muslim and Christian worlds right to this day, and his name is Sultan Saladin. Our guest today, or guide if you like, will be telling us why that is the case. Jonathan Phillips has perhaps one of the liveliest job titles in the UK. He's Professor of Crusading History at Royal Holloway University, just outside London. He's written widely on all aspects of crusading history, and this month his new biography of Saladin is published. Dan Jones, writing in the Sunday Times, has called it vivid and judicious, punctuated by set pieces that charge along like battle scenes from Game of Thrones. I met up with Jonathan in London just the other day, and I started by asking him to explain what this crusading era was all about. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Jonathan. Thanks for talking to us today about the Crusades.
Pleasure.
Right, a little bit about the crusading era to begin with. We're in the High Middle Ages. There's all sorts going on, but I just think it'd be interesting for us if we talked broadly about, you know, what's happening in the Near East at this time and why is it happening?
The Muslim Near East at the end of the 11th century is an incredibly complicated region. You've got Sunni Muslims, Shia Muslims, various splinter groups of Shia Muslims. It's a very fractured landscape. There's no sort of single power that's dominating the area. Mid-11th century, there have been a couple of big power groups. The Seljuk Turks had been driven westwards by climate change to take over what we say now is Iraq and Syria. And the Fatimid Shia dynasty are there in Egypt. But by the end of the 11th century, it's quite fragmented, very complicated indeed. Very polyglot population. You've got a lot of Eastern Christians living there. You've got Jewish population as well. So a real melting pot.
Yeah, I suppose this is an era that people kind of know in a way, in hologram form perhaps. And the Crusaders in particular are these incredibly iconic characters in the historical story. So why were they over there? What were they doing? What were they trying to achieve?
Well, the First Crusade was called by Pope Urban II at the Council of Clermont in November 1095. And he, as the head of the Catholic Church, was trying to get the Western knights to stop fighting amongst themselves, to stop perpetrating violence in Western Europe, and to go and do something that, as he saw it, was morally right, which would be to regain Jerusalem, Christ's city, from the hands of the Muslims. So he offered them a spiritual deal that if you go and carry on fighting, which you're patently rather good at, but you're doing it for this good cause, then you will receive a spiritual reward. And you will avoid, therefore, the torments of hell that undoubtedly await you for your sinful lives. So he makes this appeal. Tens of thousands of people respond to it. They're not all driven by religion or wholly by religion. Knights are also driven by a sense of honour, wanting to sort of show off and achieve great deeds. A small number are looking for land, although most people came home afterwards. And some of them are going to go because the boss tells them to go, so you have to kind of go along with your lord and master. So I think it's always a variety of reasons why people go on crusade. But religion and regaining Jerusalem, Christendom's holy city, is the driving
force.
That's
right at the heart of it. It's interesting how you talk about these confluence of factors, this idea of a common enemy, which is, you know, maybe going to bind together the Western
you know, kind of Europeans in a way. And then interesting to me, you mentioned climate change, which is something people don't readily associate with this period of history. But has there been some work going on about this recently that you're
aware? There's an Israeli scholar called Roni Ellenblum, and he was looking at sort of narratives of the 11th century. And he noticed that there's an awful lot of mentions of terrible winters. And it's clear that the Turkic peoples in Central Asia were being driven westwards because their animals simply couldn't survive on the steppe. So you've got these nomadic groups moving westward, and they're ferocious warriors, and they really will take over anybody in their path. So this is all adding to the sort of sense of flux and change in the Near East.
From
both sides, as it were.
Okay, so some chronological nuts and bolts. First Crusade is in the 1090s, more or less. And it
July 1099 is the conquest of Jerusalem.
And so that's the big
crusade moment,
isn't it, when Jerusalem falls to the Crusaders. And we have the Kingdom of Jerusalem, which is established at this point, which some people will have heard about. This is really the contextual backstory to the time travel we're going to be doing today, because throughout the 1100s, you have Jerusalem in the hands of the Christians. Incredibly iconic city, as you described it, important in all sorts of ways, in religious history and cultural history too, and as a centre geographically. And this is the time that the character you write about is born and is brought up into the world. Can you tell us who that is, please?
Saladin was a Kurd. He's born in Tikrit, which is up in modern Iraq now, on the Tigris River. Born around 1137, 1138. His Kurdish family are warriors. They're great horsemen and great fighters. And they're employed by the Syrian Turkic warlords to do a lot of fighting for them. And it's in the service of one of these great Syrian warlords, a man called Nur al-Din, that Saladin's family makes it sort of advance up the ranks, if you like. Nur al-Din is a man who's very important to Saladin's story. I think this in some ways is the great sort of unsung hero of the counter-crusade, of the jihad. The Muslim world had not really responded effectively to the First Crusade. The idea of the jihad had rather fallen into abeyance. But under Nur al-Din, he initiates a program of spiritual renewal. He is a very, very pious man. He builds a lot of madrasas. He dispenses justice in its proper form and gives the counter-crusader a sort of an intellectual and a military drive. Mm. And that's the environment that when Saladin and his family moved towards Damascus in the 1150s and 60s, that's the environment in which he's growing up in, a very sort of powerful drive against the Westerners, the idea of throwing the Franks out of Jerusalem.
Mm. And jihad is a word that we're familiar with today because, of course, it's often in the news. And you write about it really being two things, because it's the personal aspect. It's you trying to fight the battles with yourself to be a better Muslim. But then there's the external aspect as well, which is, I think, the thing that you're talking about, which is growing at this particular moment. And maybe it's crystallised in Jerusalem itself.
Yes, there is the greater jihad, which is you, as you say, fighting against your inner demons for the good of your soul. But the lesser jihad, the jihad in the world, under Nur al-Din, starts becoming focused on Jerusalem, the third most important city in Islam, the place where the Prophet ascends to heaven on his night journey, many other sort of important spiritual events and references connected with that city. And so there is a focus on the need to recover that for Islam.
Mm. And he was a Kurd, which is interesting. But then you talk about him having Damascus as his central base. So there's obviously a bit of movement going on in his early life.
And yes, it's a very fluid society. I mean, his family are employed by Nur al-Din as these warriors and administrators. And there's some time in Aleppo. And Damascus is certainly, I think, the place that Saladin liked the most. It's certainly almost somewhere he regards as home in his sort of later career and constantly tries to go back to it. And it's where he's buried as well. But yes, there is a lot of fluidity. And another place that he ends up going to in the 1160s is to Egypt. And that really is where his story starts taking off, because Egypt is a place of struggle between the Franks in Jerusalem and the Syrian Muslims, and they're both out to take over this incredibly wealthy land that's ruled by a rather failing dynasty. And so Saladin is sent in with his uncle to try to conquer Egypt for the Syrian Muslims. And this is something that they managed to achieve in early 1169.
Okay, brilliant. So one last thing I think we should just dwell on for a moment before we dive in. The Franks, what are they? Where do they come from?
The armies of the First Crusade came from all across Western Europe. So many regions represented, all drawn to the idea of trying to recover Jerusalem for Christendom. And in a sense, there's a sort of heritage of the Frankish empires of Charlemagne back in the 9th century. And so there is a sort of sense of Frankish identity that's very difficult to define, that they do share, rather than listing a great range of regions that people came from. This word comes to be a sort of a catch-all represent them. And then when they are in the Near East, it's a word that the Muslims and the people in the Near East pick up upon. They say the Frange. And so Franks is a word that works for both sides as a catch-all.
Now let's go for the heart of the matter, and this is your year, which is one of the iconic ones in the Middle Ages, surely, 1187. And we're going to go through this year in three different scenes, and you're going to tell us why it's important. Let's start off on the evening of the 2nd of July, 1187. Where are we?
We're in Galilee. We're in a tent with the King of Jerusalem, King Guy of Lusignan, the ruler of Jerusalem. And he is deciding what he's going to do because his lands have been invaded by Saladin.
So at this point, Saladin is much more powerful. How old is he at this point?
Saladin's around 50 years old at this time. And what he's been doing over the last 12 or 13 years is drawing together a fragile coalition of the Muslim Near East to defeat the Crusaders.
Mm.
But at the same time, he's very obviously building his own dynastic empire. This is the great tension with Saladin. What motivates him? Is he a holy warrior out to recover Jerusalem for Islam, or is he just a self-serving, dynastic, ambitious man? And the answer is, of course, both. They're not mutually exclusive at all. And while he certainly usurps the dynasty of his former patron, Nur ad-Din, and is pretty relentless in doing so, he's doing it under the banner of, I am the best man to lead Sunni Islam back into Jerusalem. So he's really wrapping it around himself and his family. And so after he spent these 13 years pulling together a fragile coalition of the Muslim Near East on these terms, he has to deliver. There's a point at which, you know, you can't just keep saying I'm the best man for it and you've got to come with me or I'll bully or pressure you into it. You've got to deliver. And while he's fought the Franks from time to time, he's been badly beaten by them once or twice, he really is in a position where he has to bring them to battle and deliver on his promises.
So we're at this tent of the Franks, and they know that Saladin's army has been growing. It's close by. So this is really a moment when they've got to make a decision of whether they're going to engage or not. And the numbers involved are massive, aren't they?
The Frankish army is about 20,000. Saladin's probably about 30, 35,000. But the tension is for the Franks. If they bring him to battle, of course, that's a risk. I mean, battles are inherently dangerous. And it's a sort of all or nothing situation. What they did a few years in the past when Saladin invaded was to just shadow his army. You've got to watch your lands being devastated, your crops being burnt, your animals led away. But you just stay out of reach of the punch kind of thing. And in the end, Saladin's army will just have to go home and harvest its own lands and it will break down. And in a sense, if you could keep doing that again and again, the tension, the pressure that he's under to deliver and the challenge that he has to keep his fragile coalition together will sooner or later break him. But you've got this tension. You are not being a good ruler for your people in one way if your lands are being trashed by the enemy.
So this King of Jerusalem, Guy, shall we call him, he's in this tent, and presumably because the Crusaders have been controlling this territory for, 88 years at this point, they're in the position of power. They can, I suppose, back off, if you like, as well, as much as they're aggravated by Saladin and his forces. But what happens on this day that makes it so interesting to you that you'd like to go back there to see it?
Guy summons his sort of council, his senior warriors, and they know that Saladin has taken a castle called Tiberias, and the lady of the castle is there, so there's a sort of chivalric element, rescue the lady in distress, and so there's a sort of pressure to save her as well. But his council of nobles, including her husband, it has to be said, decide that it really is the best thing not to engage Saladin. They're going to stay put, not least because Where this tent is, there's some great springs, the springs of Safaria. The army is well watered. We're in July. We're in peak summer in the Near East. And that is
even
going to be...
Even with climate change and cold winters, it's still quite extremely hot,
isn't it? And so that is a big, big part of it. Big army, 20-odd thousand men, lots of water where they are. We can just shadow him and basically sort of he'll have to go away in the end. They make a decision, and as far as everybody's concerned, that's it. And they all go off to bed. But very late at night, there is another knock at the tent. And a man called Gerard de Riedfort, the master of the Knights Templar, comes in. And he says to the king, I'd like a word with you about that decision, and I profoundly disagree with it. So this is a man who's a master of one of the great military orders, men dedicated to the defence of the Holy Land, sworn to defeat Islam. It's their job, if you like. It's their vocation, they're warrior monks. And Gerard is a very, very bellicose man. He's led a couple of other failed military engagements before, and he's smarting over those a bit. He has one or two personal grudges that are part of the thing. But also he says to Guy, look, you know, you've been king a few years. You were regent before that. Once when you were regent, you didn't fight Saladin. You stayed out of reach, and we all said it was a good thing, and then you got deposed. You were thrown out of the regency. It's the same people telling you the same thing again. How stupid are you? Are you going to fall for this again? And all these things start pressurising Guy into thinking, well, yeah, maybe I should fight Saladin. Gerard is very clever and obviously presses a lot of buttons with him about his own worth as king. And it works. Mm. And Guy goes to bed with that decision. They wake up the following morning and the heralds announce, we're going to march. And people are astounded. They question what's going on and just say, well, this is the king's decision.
So a massive logistical operation begins. I suppose if you were there, the scene would be in itself really quite impressive.
I think so. If you think of 20,000 people on the Frankish side, over 30,000 on Saladin's side, you know, armies stretch out for miles, literally. And so you've got this sort of slow-moving train heading eastwards towards Tiberias over this parched landscape. Mm. And then you've got Saladin's men who are lightly armoured horsemen, so much more mobile than the Franks, who've got heavy cavalry, but a lot of footmen too. And so Saladin's men quickly swoop around to be on both sides of the Franks. And their way of fighting really is to charge up on these light horses, fire arrows, and wheel away back to safety.
So they're picking away at the edges. Crusading kind of gear, I imagine, in a kind of very clothing sense. I can't imagine it's massively appropriate for that landscape. Either, no?
I think perhaps when we think of crusading knights, we think of knights in shining armour kind of thing. A lot of the Frankish army are going to be not very well trained, which is also part of the issue. They're people just dragged out of towns to make up the numbers. Their equipment may be some chainmail or a chainmail helmet or hat, and you've got to keep it on if there's arrows pouring in at you the whole time. Mm. It's just going to be extremely draining moving across that landscape.
Mm. And from reading your account of this, the thing that really, I mean, if we were sat on a hill watching this procession go out, fateful as it turns out to be, the thing that I'd be looking out for from your description is the True Cross, which I believe is being carried along by the Franks at the same time. Could you tell us a bit about the True Cross? Because it's such an interesting idea for me.
Yeah, part of the great talisman for the Franks is the True Cross. And after the Crusaders conquered Jerusalem in 1099, they discovered what they believed to be part of the cross upon which Christ was crucified. So a relic of inestimable value to the Christian faith. And they mounted this piece of wood in a probably a great sort of silver housing. And it has its own shrine in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. When they're going to fight battles, they take it out and it's their talisman. And they've taken it out a couple of dozen times by this
point.
And
it seems to work.
And it always works, yes. You know, victory or at least not defeat. And then it's processed back into Jerusalem, prayers of thanks afterwards. So they have their great talisman with them. So as the army moves across, I suppose you also have to imagine this silver cross processing fairly near the middle of it, I'd have thought, for safety reasons.
Mm. So let's whip through, because I think people listening to this might have a bit of an idea about what's going to happen, but what did happen over the next few days?
Over the 2 days of the Battle of Hattin, the Muslim troops picked away at the slow-moving Frankish army, wore them down. There's constant drums and trumpets as well. That's another part of the sort of psychological warfare, making this very aggressive noise all the time just to put your opponents on edge. We have that in modern warfare, the use of loud bad music as a way of deterring opponents or irritating them or putting stress on them. And after the first day, the Franks have to basically camp out on the plateau overnight. And then, very cleverly, the Muslims set fire to some of the dried grass. The wind is blowing in the correct direction, so you have smoke blowing into the parched mouths and lungs of the Franks. Makes it even more difficult for them. All the time, the Muslims have got lots of water. Coming up on camelback from the Sea of Galilee, they're really well supplied. They even pour water out in front of the Franks just to show how much they've got. Wow. You get to the second day, the Franks have still got a way to go, and the pressure continues with the drums, the trumpets, the endless attacks. And morale has really wilted by this point. I mean, they see this geological formation known as the Horns of Hattin, which is an old volcano with the rim broken, which makes the two horns. And the remains of the army struggles up to this sort of volcanic kind of cup, I suppose. And there they decide to make their last stand. Some of the horsemen have disappeared. A group of them charged at the Muslims, who very wisely just parted and let them fly through. They're not going to turn around and come back again. So that was a clever way of taking the sting out of some of the Franks' best troops. And in the end, they struggle up to the Horns of Hattin. And there's a couple of sort of big charges down the hill. They try and pick off Saladin himself, which is a good idea. But in the end, the king's tent falls and Saladin has won.
And, well, it just sounds to me like an absolute tactical masterclass. And the further they march, the more stupid the Crusaders must really look.
Yes, it's just the size of the fact their army is not very well trained. Morale must have disintegrated pretty quickly. You're talking the mid to high 30s in terms of temperature. And, you know, that's by sort of late morning. Mm. And you can just see the Muslims around you obviously looking excited, energetic, realising that victory is theirs. It was a fairly sort of slow and painful death, if you see what I mean, for that army.
In the terms of, even in the Middle Ages or the High Middle Ages, does the Battle of Hattin really rank as one of the most significant?
It is one of the most significant battles of the Middle Ages, not least because the scale of the defeat is such that Saladin is then able to, over the next few months, run through the Frankish settlements, picking off the vast majority of towns and cities and castles, because all the defenders were at the Battle of Hattin. Mm. There's almost nobody left to defend anywhere after that. Mm. And so he really does absolutely remove the knighthood of the Crusader states.
And Guy himself, what happens to him?
There's a very famous scene after the end of the battle. Saladin sets his own tent up, and he has brought before him Guy of Lusignan and a man called Reynald of Châtillon, who's sort of the walk-on baddie of the Crusader states, a very unpleasant, aggressive man, deeply unpleasant to Christians as well as Muslims. He really was a nasty piece of work. And he's a man who's upset Saladin greatly in the past. He launched a raid that threatened Medina, and that is a real challenge to Saladin. And so these two leading Franks are brought before Saladin. And to Guy, he hands a cup of iced julep, a sign of hospitality. Guy, of course, is incredibly thirsty, drinks most of it, and then hands it to Reynald. Saladin interrupts. I did not give the cup to Reynald. I did not show him that hospitality. And then he decides what he's going to do with Reynald, and almost ratcheting up the tension, he goes for a ride. He leaves the two Franks for a little bit and goes to have a think about what he's going to do next. And then he comes back to Reynald and says, well, you could convert to Islam, which of course he's not going to. Reynald declines, and then Saladin or his bodyguard strike Reynald and kill him on the spot.
Well, this is high drama, and I think brings to an end this first scene that we've been looking over, which starts a few days earlier with the Crusaders in a position of immense strength, you might say. Well, if not immense strength, but at least parity, I suppose, in some ways. There's a quote here I love that you've got, which is they were tormented by the heat of war and tortured by thirst. Not even an ant among them could have advanced, nor could have escaped to safety. The arrows struck in them and transformed those who would seem like lions into hedgehogs. I'm not quite sure who wrote that.
That's one of Saladin's entourage, who are men of great learning. They're poets, they're his secretaries and administrators. And one of the reasons I think he's so successful is that he surrounds himself with really high-quality people. He doesn't necessarily care about their background. If you're good, you come and work for me. And these men are, right, incredibly ornate. Sometimes it has to be said sort of rather overly ornate verse. But they certainly enjoy using words. And they're very much sort of part of Saladin's identity. his identity and also generating propaganda for him and concerned with his image.
And this really enables him to go on to his main aim and us to go to our second scene. And this is the Siege of Jerusalem, and this is in September. So Saladin had his heart set on Jerusalem for a long time, hadn't he?
Yes, I mean, Saladin, after the Battle of Hattin, he is able to defeat the Franks at many of their towns and castles and cities and move towards his real focus. The focus of Nur ad-Din, his former patron, and his own jihad, the idea of liberating Jerusalem for Islam. So he assembles a very, very large army, a lot of religious men with him as well, of course, anticipating the recovery of Jerusalem for the faith.
Mm. Well, I mean, Jerusalem. Simon Sebag Montefiore says that it's the house of one God, the capital of two peoples, the temple of three religions, and the only city to exist twice, in heaven and on earth. The peerless grace of the terrestrial is as nothing to the glories of the celestial. Nice quote, and I couldn't avoid using it here, but what was it like at this time? I mean, in a way, it seems timeless, Jerusalem, doesn't it? What were the major sites? What did it look like? How big was it?
It is timeless. And the walled city of Jerusalem, as Saladin was looking around, wondering how to get into it, he went up on the Mount of Olives, which you still do today. The sun rises behind the Mount of Olives, and the wonderful sunlit panorama of the old city, which still stands there. I see skyscrapers in the background outside it. But the heart of the old city is there, with the sort of sacred esplanade, with the Al-Aqsa Mosque, with the Dome of the Rock, these incredibly important sites for Islam, there in front of you are on that side of the city. But it's also then a really dense warren of medieval streets. In the Crusader era, there were a lot of churches. Some of them were Catholic Latin churches, an awful lot of Eastern Christian churches too, Greek Orthodox, Syriacs, Nestorians, Armenians. A very sort of a polyglot population of Christians, if you like, within the old city. But still, you walk through there now and it's so atmospheric, the narrow streets, the buildings, many churches. It's a very intense place.
When the Crusaders took Jerusalem in 1099, it was an incredibly brutal event, wasn't it? There was all sorts of slaughter. And I suppose, I mean, there's a particular story about people standing in blood up to their ankles or calves. Is that correct from 1099?
It's a story that's put out after the First Crusade. I think it's First Crusaders writing back to Western Europe, in a sense, showing the level of success they've achieved. They've purified that city of Muslims and achieved this great victory on behalf of Christendom. I mean, that is in a sense, is literally a sort of hype. It's not a literal fact that they were wading in blood up to their knees, and it's a phrase that's used on all sorts of sides in different situations. But it's a very, very powerful image of Christian slaughter. And there was undoubtedly in 1099 a slaughter of the Muslim and the Jewish defenders who are in the city at the time.
And I mention that mostly because the Christians inside might expect some kind of hostile retribution from Saladin, because they're really unprotected, aren't they? They haven't got any army which is going to come and save them at this point. So if we're sat up there with Saladin on the Mount of Olives, which is a nice image I'll just cherish for a moment, he can do really what he likes, can't he? But is it difficult to take the city at this point?
Jerusalem has strong walls. The citadel, the Tower of David, is quite a difficult place to get into, and he moves away from that quite quickly down to the northeast corner. In some ways, yes, he has got the opportunity to decide what to do with the defenders. He could put it to the sack, undoubtedly, and maybe some of his predecessors would have done that. And I also suspect there is some pressure from some of his holy men to perhaps enact that. I suppose retribution, revenge for what happened in 1099. But there's a wider consideration in how he should deal with Jerusalem.
Mm. Who's left in control of Jerusalem at this point? Who's the figurehead?
The main figure is a man called Balin of Ibelin, who is a nobleman. And he is the man who goes out to negotiate with Saladin. Mm. Fairly quickly, it's obvious Jerusalem is going to fall. So they enter into negotiations, which is what happens when medieval cities are about to fall. And Balian has obviously a rather sort of thin hand to play, shall we say. And Saladin is suggesting that if the Christians don't surrender, then there will be a massacre. I will massacre the men and enslave the women, he says. So Balian said, well, OK, if you're going to play hard, so will I. And unless you give us good terms, this is what's going to happen. I do have several thousand Muslim prisoners. They will all be killed. The Dome of the Rock, which I know is important to you, will be shattered. We will break up your religious sites. And because we know we're going to be killed, we're going to fight so hard, a lot of you are going to die in the process. And Saladin and his group take that thought away and realise that really it's not a good thing to do. Do they want to be responsible in some ways for the death of a lot of Muslims, of their own people? Do many of them want to die? And they certainly don't want the destruction of their holy places. So they agree to ransom the Christians inside the holy city. But in doing so, they're also, in effect, showing mercy. They could have massacred the Christians in there. And mercy is a form of power. And this is something that Saladin is well aware of. He is frequently, not always, frequently merciful, because he's aware that it saves the struggle of the Muslims trying to get into the city in the first place. It is a sign of power and generosity that you can deliver people's lives. And he's also aware that it is good reputationally. Mm. He's always keen to polish his reputation. So for a big range of reasons, he's happy to agree to this. One really quick signal of the effect of Saladin's mercy at Jerusalem in 1187 was in 1204, when the armies of the Fourth Crusade captured and sacked the great Christian city of Constantinople. And a Greek writer said, "Look at you lot, Christians, you've massacred Christians in a Christian city. A couple of decades ago, Saladin, a Muslim, spared the Christian defenders. Shame on you."
Well, I suppose this is the kind of stuff he would have been turning over in his head up on the Mount of Olives. And you mentioned the religious significance of the Dome of the Rock. It might just be worth pointing that out now. Why was this such an important site for Muslims?
The Dome of the Rock has within it a rock upon which the Prophet began his ascent to heaven. And there is the sort of the last footprint. And it's housed in this gorgeous structure. You often see it on television today with a big gold dome. It's where TV correspondents tend to do their piece with that in the background, almost as a sort of symbol of Jerusalem.
And had this survived for the period of Frankish control?
Yes, it had. It had. They turned it into a church. And so it's got a lot of sort of actually Frankish decoration in parts of it.
And the other thing you mention is the Great Cross. Is it on top of the Dome of the Rock? They had a Great Cross up there.
There was a Great Cross on top of the Dome of the Rock. And often when places fall, there's a moment, a symbolic moment. At the end of the Berlin Wall, perhaps that statue of Saddam Hussein toppling. And when the Muslims get into Jerusalem, the Great Cross on top of the Dome of Rock is toppled. Wow. And that really is, okay, that's the end of the Christian hold of Jerusalem.
Well, I think this is really, if we're on the Mount of Olives for your second scene, your third has to be a few days later when the cross comes tumbling down. This is the interesting thing here, because it maybe takes some people by surprise the magnanimity which is shown. And that's really the overriding, what should we say, quality of those days, isn't it?
Yes. When Saladin chooses to ransom the defenders, I mean, he's going to get a lot of money to reward his own people. He decides he's not going to destroy the Holy Sepulchre, incidentally, which is another thing that was open to him. But again, he respects that and he realises that it's going to be counterproductive. And again, when Muslims took over the city back in the 7th century, that hadn't happened. So he looks for the precedent back towards that. So he is very much aware of what he's doing.
So let's go to your third scene. And so the negotiations have taken place. The surrender's been agreed. Mm. There's generally a policy of magnanimity there in place. And we get to the 2nd of October, 1187. And were we there on that day? This really is the crowning moment of Saladin's career, isn't it? What's going on?
It is absolutely the moment that's going to put his name in history forever. This is the day that he formally enters Jerusalem. I mean, the negotiations, as you say, have been completed. This, you know, it's in Muslim hands, effectively. But this is his formal entry into the city that is carefully timed to coincide with the anniversary of the Prophet's night journey. This is the sort of thing that gives his entry into the city an extra religious significance by making that date coincide. Saladin's very aware of the religious symbolism. He wants to be seen as having achieved this great victory for Islam. He's got divine approval for what he's done. And it's very important to him to send that message out, not least because he has taken a bit of criticism over the previous 10, 15 years for being out to build his own dynastic empire. And while he has done that, he's been consistent in saying he's doing it for Islam. And now he's got Jerusalem back. There you are. I have divine approval. You can't argue with this. The first Friday prayers that are going to be held in the Al-Aqsa Mosque for 88 years. There's, if you like, a competition as to who should deliver the sermon. And so that's, again, wrapped up in a great sense of ceremony. It effectively has to be done as an open-air sermon because so many people have to want to listen to it. And it really is a moment of triumph for him. And so his group around him, with their great writing skills, are churning out these missives across the Muslim Near East, telling people that their man has done it.
And this is hugely symbolic. In a way, we do have a very strong picture of him through these scenes. He comes across as an incredibly able leader, as the person who, first of all, is very good tactically, like drawing his opponents out into dangerous situation and dealing with them very vigorously there. Then you also get the sense of the negotiator, which has all sorts of different aspects to it, you know, showing mercy and showing power, realizing when you've got a strong hand and realizing when a precedent should be respected. And then finally, this sense of the leader having to show his own prestige, that's for sure. And this is really the big story we're telling today, is how this one man changed notions of chivalry and leadership. And I think that's really the heart of the story.
In a sense, for Saladin's later reputation, particularly in the West, it's interesting that the moment when he recovers Jerusalem, in one way he's dealt Christianity the most savage blow possible. I mean, the Pope is supposed to have died of a heart attack when he heard the news. Yet, in sparing the Christians in 1187, in contrast to what the Christians did to the Muslims in 1099, he's laid a real foundation stone for his reputation, for his esteem in Western Europe forever. And I think the Knights of Western Europe were always assimilating that and, in a sense, contrasting it with their own behaviour. I mean, the fall of Jerusalem will trigger the Third Crusade. He knows the moment he goes in there that the West will respond. Very few of them meet Saladin. Richard and Saladin never met. A lot of the dealings are with Saladin's brother, who we call Saffredin. And I sometimes wonder if the Western image is a bit of a blend of Saladin and Saffredin together. Mm. But they're certainly sharing the attributes of generosity, courtesy, gift-giving, almost competitive gift-giving. My gift is finer than yours. No, mine's better than that. A love of music, poetry, courtesy towards women, particularly female prisoners. And Western Europe sees this behaviour, and it's everything that it likes about its own knights. Knights want to act like that. And so they see something that, rather than being this sort of terrible enemy, is something that they can respect very, very quickly.
Mm. You've got another quote here which says, "The king must be inclined to mercy in his rule, for he has the power to do whatever he wishes. No one earns fame and good repute in the world for injustice and evil, but rather for right conduct and mercy. He who is dominated by anger is like the demons, but he who is merciful and shows forbearance resembles the prophets." And this is a completely contemporary quote at the time of the taking of Jerusalem. And it suggests to me that it had an impact, which was very quickly absorbed into the culture that was around there at the time. I suppose if we were talking about this as the sack of Jerusalem in 1187, it would be a very different story, wouldn't it, that we're talking about today. The consequences probably may have been similar in some ways. There would still have been another crusade.
Absolutely.
To recapture what had happened. But you do get at the same time the sense that something changed at that moment. Is that right?
Had Saladin massacred the defenders of Jerusalem in 1187, undoubtedly his perception in the West would have been very, very different. In sparing the Christians in the Holy City, he laid a cornerstone, a foundation stone, that really could not be shaken. It's something that the Knights of Western Europe will forever admire, that he had it in his power to kill those Christians, and he showed mercy. In doing so, he's following some of the advice books that are around in the 11th, 12th century Near East. But basically, mercy is a form of power, defined as such since classical times. And Saladin is aware of the power of mercy, the propaganda value of mercy, the reputational value of mercy, and the practical value, because he saved himself a lot of trouble in making those decisions. But if he'd massacred the defenders in 1187, yes, his reputation in the West however he came across in the course of the Third Crusade would nowhere near have the standing that it does.
But this moment here we're talking about, so October 2nd, 1187, this is the high point for him, isn't it? This is Saladin at his best, a moment of glory.
It is his great achievement for his faith. And he could do nothing more for it, in a sense, other than actually defend it, because he will inevitably face the Third Crusade. And I suppose having recovered Jerusalem, his next task is then to hold on to it, because having triggered something that will be an enormous response from the West, he's going to then spend the remaining 6 years of his life, first of all in a sort of slightly waiting for the bomb to drop phase, knowing that Western Europe will come at him, and then 2 or 3 years of incredibly tough, arduous fighting, holding on to his position in the Near East. And I think it's fair to say, while the Third Crusade makes some holdings for the Christians on the coast, in the end they go away. And if you're looking at sort of Saladin just in the last few months of his life, you say, well, okay, they've got some places on the coast back, but I still have Jerusalem.
Well, I think that's a really good place to leave the time travels, because we've sat by the Sea of Galilee and watched the army assemble. We've sat on the Mount of Olives and watched the negotiations take place. So I think that is a pretty epic story, but it's a really intriguing character at the heart of it. We now have a few supplementary questions, which I'm going to spring on you. First of all, I don't know if you've been warned about this, but I'm going to ask you, if you could bring one object back from this moment in history to today, is there anything particular you'd like to bring back in our time machine with you?
I suppose I could say the True Cross, but that's probably a bit above my pay station. So no, maybe I shouldn't say that.
You could have it in your office in Royal Holloway. It might be a useful bargaining.
Is that going to fall into the changing history kind of thing? What would I like? Let me think. If I could bring something back with me, it might be one or two of Saladin's poetry collection. I'd be intrigued to learn what he had in his possession. And it would be interesting for me to be able to understand what it was that he had around him in terms of his entourage and the people near him.
Well,
if it was a bit more selfish, he could give me one of his wonderful robes of honour, because he's always dishing out robes of honour to people, and these are wonderful silken objects. And more selfishly, perhaps, I'd like one of them.
Oh, well, that'll do you good for the book tour, I suppose. Can tell us a bit more about the book now. So Sultan Saladin is your book. It's going to be published very, very soon. So what have you tried to do in this book, and why is it, and how is it different, should I say, to the other books about Saladin that are already out there?
What I tried to do is to describe Saladin's life, to understand how he achieved what he achieved. But also I wanted to follow his afterlife. I was in Damascus in 2009, just walking down the street, and I saw an advert for Saladin the Ballet. Who can resist? And I went in and watched it, and it was a major event in the downtown opera house in Damascus. And it was a celebration of his achievements. And it got me thinking as to, well, you know, this was 2009, what a powerful memory that still is. But I wanted to sort of see how that memory had survived down the centuries. What twists and turns had it taken?
And how was the Saladin dance performance in Damascus? Would it be recommended?
It was a very interesting cultural event. I'm not sure I'm a convert to dance musicals or ballets or things like that. But it really was a powerful, dynamic performance.
Well, there we go. I think he obviously, as a historical character, was incredibly influential. And as you say, retaking Jerusalem is, in the history of the Middle Ages, one of these key events. And if anyone wants to explore this idea much more thoroughly, I'd recommend your book, which is out right now and is full of interesting things, not just the history, but as we said, the legend as well. Thank you very much for talking to us today, Jonathan.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, that was me talking with Jonathan Phillips about 1187, the Holy City of Jerusalem, and most of all, Sultan Saladin just the other day. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation. And if you do want to explore in much more detail the things that we were talking about, the battles, the personalities, the effect this cult of personalities had on the Middle East in the 1,000 years or so since, I'd really recommend Jonathan's book. It's a wonderful one to explore, and I really enjoyed reading it. If you've enjoyed the show, of course, we'd like you to subscribe so you get the first news of the next episode as soon as it becomes available. Our next episode is going to be out in a fortnight, as ever, and it's going to be with the literary historian Lucasta Miller, who's taking us back to the scene of a 19th century murder, or a bit of a literary cover-up she's exposed. So that's really, really worth listening out for. But from me, and for now, that's it. Thank you very much again for listening, and goodbye.
I'm Paul Lay, the editor of History Today. On our website, you'll find articles written by experts relating to Jonathan Phillips' troubles. You can read Norman Housley on Saladin's triumph at the Battle of Hattin. Robert Irwin looks at how Islam saw the Christian invaders, while Jonathan Phillips himself offers a complete history of the Crusades. Links to all of these pieces can be found at www.historytoday.com/troubles. And there are many more articles on every aspect of the past in our monthly publication, History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine.